I think what a lot of people don't understand is the uniqueness of our biodiversity. New Zealand, Aotearoa, evolved isolated for a long, long time and didn't go through an ice age like Europe. And so a lot of our species are really ancient and they're not found anywhere else. And it means that they're just so vulnerable to what we've introduced. Basically, we've just brought all these mammals and predators in that just weren't here. So New Zealand was a land of birds, of reptiles, and of invertebrates. There were no land mammals apart from bats. And that is nowhere else in the world is like that. It's really unique. So all our species are really unique. Most of our, I think like 80% of our species in New Zealand of flora and fauna are endemic. They're not found anywhere else. So surely that means we want to hold on to them. You know, they're more precious because they are endemic. And I do feel like we have a responsibility for the planet to hold on to that biodiversity. It's not just for New Zealand, it's actually for the whole planet that biodiversity doesn't get lost.
Hello, kia ora, and welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast, brought to you by Conservation Amplified.
Our show features the stories of people who are helping nature to bring more awareness to this amazing space.
I'm Callum.
And I'm Anna. And in today's episode, we're joined by Carmelin Graham from Kaharua Kōkako Trust.
Welcome aboard, and I'm really excited to talk about how people like you are bringing Kōkako back from the brink of extinction and some of the awesome work you're doing. Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Sure, I'm Graham. I'm currently the chair of the Kōkako Trust. I've been involved, I moved to Kaharoa just as the trust was starting. So I started out as a volunteer. People knocked on the door and said, can you come and help? And I said yes. And I've just been doing it ever since and got onto the trust, and now I'm kind of a symbolic leader because no one else would do it. And Carmel was there before I even started.
Hi, Carmel. I started as a volunteer as well. I was helping with the early work in Kaharoa, working alongside Hazel Speed. That was part of a 8-year research program. And after that, the trust started, and yeah, I've been involved ever since, mainly as a volunteer, but also doing survey work on contract. That's kept me very busy.
Carmel's the only trustee that's been there every year from the beginning.
That's awesome.
That's a commitment.
Yeah.
But before we get stuck into it, what is a kōkako for people who are not very, don't know the species, don't know the bird?
It's a $50 note, isn't it?
It is.
Kōkako are in the wattlebird family, along with the extinct huia and the not extinct but not very common tiaki or saddleback. They're an ancient family of birds found only in New Zealand. And the kōkako would have been common throughout most of our, certainly the North Island forests, but is not common now, and is the Bay of Plenty is the stronghold for them, really. Bay of Plenty and some of central North Island. They're a bit bigger than a tui, but not as big as a magpie. They do have wattles, so they have beautiful cobalt blue wattles just on each side of their bill. Beautiful black bill, a really cool Zorro mask around their eyes. Their plumage is a lovely grey-blue, and black legs, long black legs for leaping and running through the forest, through the canopy. And quite short rounded wings, which are very good for gliding, but they're not good flyers at all. And a long fan sort of tail, which is also very good for gliding. So they would have been on the evolutionary sort of line of becoming flightless. They're not good flyers at all. They can't fly in a straight line for more than about 50 meters, but they're extremely good at gliding and running and hopping and leaping. They probably would have spent time on the ground, but the ones that spent the most time on the ground have probably all been taken out of the gene pool. And you don't often see kōkako on the ground except on predator-free islands, Turituri Matangi and Hautūru. What else can I say? They have a beautiful song, which is how they proclaim their territory. They usually sing from a high point, like top of a ridge in a tall tree, and other birds around them will reply. Their song can carry a long way, like up to a kilometer on a still morning, and they have different dialects. So the birds singing in Kaharō have a different song to the birds in Rotowehu or Mokaihaha or anywhere else, which is tricky if you're wanting to translocate birds. They make all sorts of sounds, but their song is really beautiful and quite haunting and very varied. They eat all sorts of things. They eat foliage all through the year, but in the breeding season, they eat a lot of invertebrates, and they need to have fruit and flowers and foliage, a good variety of them throughout the year. So they need good quality forest to be able to live in, and that means not just not the predators, but good forest that doesn't have, that's not eaten out basically by ungulates and wallabies and things like that. All the regen species are very productive with fruit and flowers, and they're all really important. How long do you want me to go on?
That's perfect.
I've already learned a few things about kōkako. They are truly amazing birds and quite a rare sight in the forest. Before this call, I read on NZ Birds Online that back in 1999, they had 380 pairs left, and I think they said it was 2,080 pairs as of 2021. So that's an awesome recovery, but that's still very vulnerable, very rare. Right. What makes them so vulnerable?
They're mainly because they, during the breeding season, they're mostly vulnerable. A lot of our native birds smell, and predators use scent to find their prey. But a lot of our birds are quite strong smelling. I know you will find, working with kiwi, they have a really strong smell. Not many people get to smell kōkako up close, but they do have quite a sweet, musty smell. And it means when they nest, it's very easy for rats or possums, stoats, to find their nest. The other thing that makes them very vulnerable during the breeding season is that it's the female who builds the nest. She lays the eggs, she incubates the eggs, and she broods the chicks. And so she's in that one spot for over 50 days, and that makes her very vulnerable, as well as the eggs and the chicks. So what's happened and how populations have declined is that over not a long period of time, but over time, the females will add all the chicks and eggs. So the reproduction, as well as the adult females, get taken out of the population. And males and females look the same. The males are a little bit bigger and heavier, but adult male and female kōkako look the same. So when work was initially being done, some populations we thought, you know, had a reasonable number of birds in them, but what was found was they were mainly all males, old males. So the breeding was almost, you know, over. So during the breeding season is when kōkako are most vulnerable to predation.
Now that is definitely, you know, true for a lot of our species with the smell. And I was never been fortunate enough to smell kōkako, but hopefully one day. In Kaharua itself, how did Kaharua Kōkako Trust start?
When did it start?
When I mentioned when I first started working there with Hazel, that was part of an 8-year research into why kōkako were declining. in the 80s, the Wildlife Service found kōkako in Kahuroa, but some of the scientists were already looking at some of our bird species and wondering why they were still declining, even though forest clearance had sort of stopped. And that was the case with kōkako. So I don't know how they funded it, but an 8-year research program was started, and Kahuroa was one of three forests that the research was done in. And it was basically, it was 4 years of pest control and 4 years without. Kahuroa was one forest, Rutuaihu was another, and Mapra in the King Country was the other. And Mapra was used as the control, with pest control throughout the whole time. But that was the forest that had mainly male birds. So even though they were getting really good pest control, they weren't breeding, and it wasn't until they did DNA testing that they found out that it was actually wasn't anything to do with the pest control. It was the fact that they were all old males. I think there was only three females in the whole population. So that was a different learning. But in Kahuroa and Rotuaihu, we had 4 years of pest control. Well, it was actually three, but 4 years of pest control and then 4 years without. And Hazel and I were monitoring kōkako throughout that whole 8 years. And we were measuring them by doing an adult census in the spring, so a census of the adult population. And then in the summer, late summer, we'd do a juvenile survey, which meant we went around all the pairs that we'd found in the census and looked for chicks that they may have produced, because the chicks stay with the adults for a while, sometimes a few months, sometimes not very long at all. In Kahuroa, the chicks tend to hang around with their, either with their parents or hang around with adults for months at a time. So I was involved with all that, and at the end of that study, basically a recipe came out of it saying it was predators that were causing kōkako to continue to decline, the main ones being rats and possums, but since then we've also added stoats as the three main problems. And Kahuroa finished that program with no pest control, so 4 years of no pest control but monitoring, which was very hard to do, because during the pest control years, kōkako population in Kahuroa increased, and the chick production like tripled. It was up in the late 80s%, yeah, successful fledging of chicks. But with no pest control, that just plummeted. And in the last 2 years, no kōkako pairs produced any chicks at all successfully. They all tried, but predators got them all, basically. So it was really obvious that pest control was crucial during the breeding season. However, at the end of that research work, Kahuroa had 4 years of no pest control, and the Department of Conservation had tried to get funding to start pest control again, but they didn't get any funding. So there was no assurance that pest control was going to start anytime soon. And
what years was this? You did the 8-year study in the 1980s, was it? Or?
It was the late 80s through until 1997 was when it finished. And basically, I'd been asked to look for kōkako on a private property nearby, and we didn't find any. But I got questioned, and that was Peter Davey, and he was horrified that there was no money to start pest control again. So he'd just recently formed a trust and knew how to set a trust up. So a group of locals basically started a trust, but we actually started pest control in Kahuroa in 1997 before we'd formally set up a trust. So that's when we started, basically.
Wow, that's amazing. So really it was that there was a need for it, but the money wasn't there to do it. So you said, hey, let's band together and make it happen, because we can't let these kōkako disappear.
Yeah, that is why. And Kahuroa is the kōkako there. It's an original population, so the genetics are valuable. It's not a translocated population.
Why do the genetics matter so much? Like, I mean, isn't a bird a bird a bird, or is there some difference in value of one kōkako versus another one? I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
Well, we do know genetics are important in all species. And because kōkako are so vulnerable to predation, and because they don't fly, like kereru, they can't fly between forests. So we end up with populations of kōkako, generally smallish populations, that are isolated from each other in fragmented bits of forest. So they can't find other birds to reproduce and keep the genetics healthy and robust. And so you end up with populations that become smaller and smaller and infertile. It's just not good for populations to drop really low in numbers. It's called bottlenecking, because they generally become, what's the word? They're not thrifty. They're not strong in their genetics.
Not vibrant. It's even worse than that. That about 10 or so years ago, some research was done that indicated that for a viable long-term population to get past calamitous events like perhaps a disease or something, you need about 250 pairs, just so you got enough diversity to enable that population to have a few individuals that would survive. And so all populations are striving to reach 250 pairs, and only two ever have on the mainland. And so the genetic diversity is really critical, and there will be genes in kākāroa that aren't found anywhere else, or expressions mm-hmm. of the genes that aren't found anywhere else. And so losing any population is,
it's not good.
It ain't good.
Yeah.
No. So all populations are valuable.
So that's so interesting, because later in this conversation, I'm really excited to talk to you about how wildlife corridors can solve that problem. But before we get to that, fast forward to 2024. That's, 20-something years since Kaharoa started. What do you do today? What are the activities that Kaharoa looks after now?
Oh, crikey. Crikey. Well, when we started, when the group started, it was unusual to have a conservation group being run by the community. And it was unusual for DOC, and we were sort of a bit of a test bed in the local area for how the interactions between the groups would go, between the DOC, the professionals, the people who were tasked to look after our wildlife, and a bunch of basically amateur conservationists jumping in to try and do the work. So at that stage, it was basically creating bait lines or lines through the bush for bait stations to be put in, and then once a year carrying out a pest control operation. But as we all know, successive governments, or all governments, have underfunded DOC. None of them are given it enough funding or staff or impetus or importance. Mm-hmm. And so there's just been an ongoing decline in what DOC can actually manage to do. They get given more and more land to look after. They get more and more requirements for output, like looking after national parks and the huts and things that are deteriorating. And the wildlife's just fallen off. And so from that early days, where DOC was a full partner, they would come and they would instruct people how to do things. They would turn up on work days to do some of the work. They would assist with monitoring, for example, rats or possums after the operation. All that's declined. So the trust suddenly became responsible, for example, in doing all the paperwork for a pest control. And that actually blew out some of the early trustees. They just couldn't deal with it, the effort that was required, the extra work that was involved. But unfortunately, the assistance from the government has got less and less and less. So now we do all the road maintenance because of the road in our blocks. We do all the track maintenance. We do all the plant protection and care. We do all the weed management. We do all the bird management. We do all the monitoring required to ensure that our population and our environment up there in the forest is successful. So we have pika pika tuaroa, the long-tailed bat, so we do bat monitoring. We have kōkako, obviously, so we do kōkako monitoring. We do five-minute bird count monitoring to make sure the other birds in the forest are doing well. We do insect monitoring. All of this is basically to ensure that what we're doing is successful. We've had years where we've done pest control and they've been basically disasters, and we know they're disasters because we measure it. But at the same time, they may not knock the rats back, but because we're doing this other monitoring, this other work, we can tell that we are actually improving the forest slowly. The most recent thing that we've really had to step up and take over from DOC is ungulate management. So pigs, goats, deer, the government just doesn't give local DOC enough money to manage those problematic animals within our resource. So we're now taking that over as well. We do all the iwi liaison. We have two lovely groups who we work with. There's Ngāti Rangawaewihi and Tapuwika. So we work with those people. So the whole combined thing, basically, we are the guardians of the forest. We do everything. So it's not just looking after kōkākau. It's measuring everything, finding the money to fund everything, and then running the whole show. So we do everything.
That's a huge amount of work. And
I don't know what would happen. If we were working, we wouldn't be able to do the work up there that we do. Over the years, we've had a declining assistance from the general community, and that is quite clearly due to the fact that there are so many really neat conservation job things going on around the community now. When we started, we were the only one, and now those community groups everywhere are doing fantastic work, so that spreads the volunteer base. It's got very expensive to drive your car around with petrol prices increasing and the rest of it, and we are a long way out of town. And we're a long way from all the population centres. And so the lovely assistance we do get, actually, they come from a long way, some of them. Some of them come from Tauranga, Papamoa, quite a lot from Rotorua, not many from Kahuroa, surprisingly. So we've just had a decline in the amount of people we've had. So we also have to start finding funding, unfortunately, for contractors to do a lot of work because we just can't do it all ourselves anymore.
Raises the importance of awareness, right? We're down in a place called Hamarana, which is one of the closest areas to Kahuroa, and we're still 25 minutes drive from where the work goes on. And that doesn't sound like much, but when you think you've got to add almost an hour round trip to your journey, it definitely means that some days that if it was just around the corner, you would go, that it's harder to. But I guess this breeds the question. You've seen the evolution of community conservation in the time since you started Kahuroa to now. What is the role of community in the conservation space?
Oh, God, it's sad to say this, but it's basically taking over the job that DOC was meant to do. I don't know how to put it more politely than that. DOC have lost the ability to do the management of our wildlife.
Yeah.
They're certainly doing a lot of good, they're doing a lot of great work, but in the general average forest around New Zealand, it's not DOC that's looking after its community groups. They'll be doing the big stuff, like the aerial 1080 drops in the South Island for saving the birds and stuff down there. But in general, conservation groups are doing what we all thought was what DOC was produced for, what DOC was created for, wildlife conservation.
It is good that community groups are doing it, doing a lot of conservation work. And I think into the future, that's the way it needs to go. People need to be aware, and if we've found that once people are aware of things, they want to help, and they want to look after the environment. So the idea of helping people become more aware is really good, and I think that is how conservation will go in the future. Mm. But there's a real need for the Department of Conservation to still be there and to be advisory, at least, because we've been doing this for 27 years, but we still need advice on things, and we can't research everything, there's still a real need for advice and for good standard practice for a whole lot of things, and that's where a government agency like DOC should be there to do and provide to community groups.
There's something you said before, Graham, which is that the community is becoming, we are the guardians of the forest as that community. And I think that is 100% right. That's definitely a trend in the Bay of Plenty and in New Zealand. In a way, quite often, I find that extremely inspiring that people are stepping up. How can we inspire more people to do that? Because you do quite a lot of work with school kids, don't you? As the trust.
Yeah, we do. and the school kids are fantastic. Some of these kids, I just can't believe how much they know, these, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 year olds, but it's sort of one or two in a group, and I guess their parents have an interest in some way in the environment, and so they come along to see us, and they know, already know a lot of the stuff. But also there's an older group coming through, and you'll know a lot about this, Anna. In the Bay of Plenty, we're really lucky that we have this group called the Bay Conservation Alliance, and they've created, using Jobs for Nature funding, a training scheme for cadets in conservation. And this isn't sort of a desktop exercise or a sit in the classroom exercise. These people go out and learn how to do practical jobs in the environment, like freshwater monitoring, trapping, plant protection and plant recognition, all sorts of things that practical people in the environment need to know. And we're kind of inspired by this because we've been sitting around all these years thinking, what the hell is going to happen when we're too old to do this? There's nobody coming through the system. But these people are, and it's really revolutionized environmental work in the Bay of Plenty. They've been absolutely fantastic.
That's so cool. Jobs for Nature has been transformational. I think another point you touched on before, that a lot of the Jobs for Nature funding has gone to establishing new conservation projects, is one that I've noticed a lot. Before doing the business I'm currently running, I was building a company that sold native plant extracts, and this is what resulted in the Reforestation Fund, which turned into Conservation Amplified. And one of the things we said was we want to fund conservation. And when we talked about reforestation, almost every single person that talked to me said, oh, so you want to plant new forest, you want to put trees in the ground. And my response was almost always, yeah, planting trees is good, but we have all these original remnant forests. We have native forests that are millions of years old that are dying off because we don't have pests. We don't have pests under control, and they are eating the forest understory, and our birds are seed dispersal, which is being killed off, which means that we don't have new seeds going along. So I would much rather protect an existing patch of forest before planting a new forest. And just you talking about that really made me think there's a need for awareness that there's already cycles going on in our nahiri and our forest and our ecosystems, and protecting the existing cycles is much more important than creating new cycles on land where it's already broken down.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you're right, planting trees, lots of people think when you talk about conservation that it's nothing but planting trees. It's a significant part of conservation, although we've done very, very little planting in Kaharoa because we've got an existing forest. But for many people wanting to contribute, they think that's what it's all about. And it works really well because without many skills, you can go along and make a difference by planting. But many of the jobs in conservation are quite crucial that you have a good understanding of the environment, that you have a good level of bush skills, that you can, and a good set of practical skills. And those aren't things you can teach people on a come down on a Saturday and don't come back for 4 months. That's sort of things that you have to have people consistently coming to do. Now, planting is a brilliant thing because anyone can sort of go along and plant some plants without much training and make a difference. But some of the stuff we do, you just have to have the long-term knowledge. You have to have the long-term involvement before you can actually start contribute strongly. And we're lucky at the moment. We've got a lot of new people coming along. And out of those lot of new people, a lot of them won't come back a lot because their lives are busy or because they've got young children and can't, or, you know, we've got to go soccer on Saturday morning. So lots of reasons why people can't come. But out of the large number of new people we've got, there will be some who will keep coming back and then will start to contribute on their own sort of level. They won't have to go with an experienced person to assist. They will be the person that's going into the work. But it is a tricky one because for many people who want to contribute, it necessarily has to be a long-term commitment rather than just pop down and plant some trees or something. It's quite difficult because there's such a range of skills that are required, and one of the main ones is being able to look after yourself in a forest environment or a mountain environment or whatever type of environment you're working in, and keeping yourself safe.
Yeah, that's right. But what you do is Karo Kukako Trust, and what I always find super enjoyable are working days, because that's the perfect opportunity to get involved and get stuck in. But quite often you get paired up with someone who knows the drill that can keep you safe while you're there, and that's an amazing learning opportunity, isn't it?
It is good. We're very lucky there in many ways. We've got a roading structure that runs along the main ridge deep into the forest, right to the far end of the forest. So you can fire people into the bush without much walking effort. And then we've got a whole range of tracks that come off those, ranging from gnarly things that I don't even want to go near anymore to quite nice strolls. There's some really good patches of bush, and some are pretty scruffy regen. So you can find bits and pieces that will suit people. And when we do working days, I like to encourage as many families, you know, quite young families, to come along when we're doing monitoring, for example, because their monitoring lines are short, only 450 metres long. Excuse me. They're usually pretty easy to get to. So that's a great family thing. You can come along, collect cards that have been put out overnight in the tunnel. Kids can see rat tracks and stuff on them, which is quite fun, and a few insect things. It just makes it a fun day for people. I really enjoy those days. Well, firstly, I love those days because I love getting the data. But second, I love the days because you get little kids coming out, you get young teenagers coming out, family groups and stuff. It's quite fun.
You also get sausages and scones and biscuits and tea. It's great. I think about 2 hours in, I'm thinking, oh, I wonder what sausages we have today.
Yeah.
I think our barbecue got stolen.
Yeah, we don't know where the
barbecue. We haven't had sausages for a while.
Yeah, we don't know whether we've left it in someone's shed and they've forgotten about it, or whether it's got pinched when we least leave it in the bush, or what happened to it. We might have to get a new one.
Okay. So bringing it back to... Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Now, that's amazing. The other thing I want to touch on, Karawa is really lucky because not only is there a lot of site-specific knowledge and you've got a good kōkaku population, there is another forest called Ōtane Wanuku, who also have a kōkaku population, and there's this amazing initiative wanting to connect those two forests for better kōkaku corridors, and hopefully in time better genetic diversity, and we've already learned they're not great flyers, so they really do need our help to have forests they can hop over to each other. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, we can. So I said before, we need these 250 pairs of birds for a genetically viable or long-term safe population. So kōkaku tend to need about 8 hectares of land, of good forest, should I say, to live in, because they need a diversity of vegetation types so they can live all year round, obviously, to find the food they need. So they need about 8 hectares each. So we're talking 250 pairs, 8 hectares a pair, 2,000 hectares. Kaharoa, we're looking after every spot of land we can get at Kaharoa, public conservation land. It's only 950 hectares. So we will never achieve the goal that the National Kōkaku Recovery Group has said we need to hit, these 250 pairs. And they actually have a set of options of how you might improve. And obviously one of them for us is the one we have to take, which is to expand outside the core area, outside the, in our case, the managed area, which is public conservation land. So I think that was about 2015 they came up with that. And Carmel got onto that. And I'll let her tell the story. She sort of pushed it and made this thing start to happen.
Well, for a number of years after we were informed that that's sort of what we needed to do, we didn't do anything because we just thought, oh my goodness, how are we going to get people on board to do pest control using toxins and, you know, because that's what we rely on. We rely on toxins. We do trapping, but using toxins is a big part of it. And we didn't think a lot of landowners would like the idea of having to put toxin out. So we just left it. But whenever I had the opportunity, I'd mention it. I'd bring it up. You just put it out there. Just put it out there. And it was actually at a Ōtane Wanuku Kiwi Trust AGM. I mentioned it. And he was on the regional council, I think. One of the guys asked if kōkaku would travel through pine trees. And I said, yes, they would. They wouldn't necessarily live in them because they wouldn't necessarily be able to find enough food. but they'd certainly use them to travel through. And out of that, he sort of said that he felt like there'd be money available to help farmers plant with that in mind, or use sort of plantings that will be valuable to them in the future but would be helpful for kōkako. So I thought, oh, someone's saying there's money available. So I went to our local dock and spoke to some of the people there, and it just started happening from there. And it was, so about 2017, we actually had a core group of entities. So it was Kahuro Kōkako Trust, there was DOC, the Regional Council, and then QE2, and
Ngā Whenua Rahui.
Ngā Whenua Rahui. And it's just got bigger since then. We've got lots of landowners involved now. We call ourselves KEEP, which is Kōkako Ecosystem Expansion Program. And the whole idea of it is to try and connect up Kaharoa and Ōtāne Wānuku, which are, the forests are only about 8 kilometres as the crow flies. They're not very far apart. And the good thing about the Kaharoa area is that the terrain is a bit up and down, and there are lots of gorges with forests still in them. So there are lots of connecting corridors anyway, and if birds really wanted to, they could get between the two forests, but they need encouragement, and the main thing they need is to be pushed. So our job in Kaharoa is actually to improve all our pest control and breed the birds fast and lots of them, so that they've got to find other places to go, and that will push them out of Kaharoa into other bits of forest and push them through this corridor. And they've already been doing that. And in the past, when we've had better breeding because of our pest control, there were birds moving out of our management area into private land. And those are the landowners that we're now working with to improve all that. Yeah. So, and there's a care, Paraiti Catchment Care Group. Catchment Care Group seem to be a really good way to go now, because
what is a catchment care group?
A catchment care group are landowners that live in a water catchment, basically. The Paraiti Catchment Care Group are, the core group are all farmers, but they do different sort of farming. It's a tight little community, and they've got a school sort of right in the middle of it, Te Ranga School. But they all want, they recognise that the Paraiti River is a clear, it's a good river, it's mostly clean, and they want to keep it that way. And they want, so they're getting all sorts of advice and learning heaps, and part of what they want also is they want kōkako back. A number of the landowners either recall having kōkako on their properties when they were young, or certainly their parents. So a lot of the landowners are third and fourth and fifth generation on the same farm, and they'd really like in their patches of forest to have kōkako back there. So we want to help that happen. And landowners between Kaharoa and Ōtāne Wānuku, that's what we're finding a lot of them are keen to be involved with. And KEEP has got funding now to be able to help make these things happen. You might want to elaborate.
Yeah, so how do you make it happen? What does it involve? Remnants in the valleys, right?
We've had some unbelievable support along the way of KEEP. The first thing that happened is that a American forestry company, private forestry company called Port Blakeley, wanted to buy a couple of forests that are on our boundaries. And to do that, you've got to apply to the Overseas Investments Office. And I think you have to show that there is more advantage to New Zealand by a foreign country buying the forest than there is for a Kiwi company to buy it. So they said, all right, we'll give nearly $100,000 for kōkako management. And they came to us and said, oh, we're buying these forests, we've got all this money, we don't know what to do with it because we don't know how to do kōkako management. We can just give it to you if you like. Sounds like $100,000 in your pocket suddenly without any expectation. And we said, no, we'd rather work with you on a program together to try and work out how we can make this happen. Well, what's come out of that is they have on our borders, two places, we've got a total of about an extra 180 hectares, I think, that they've put bait stations into, protecting the area. So immediately that's advanced our area. And then we were kind of considering, well, how do we go to farmers and tell them, we want you to plant trees to infill a corridor and put land aside that you've probably got productive land that you, you know, that we can't go and tell them how to do it. We were sort of mulling, how would we extend our this sort of idea onto the farms that we didn't even know the people? And boom, out of the blue, they came to us as a Kukaroa Trust and said, we're starting this care group. Can you come and give us advice on pest control and stuff? We want to get Kukaku back. It was just like a magic moment of we went from how do we go and approach these people and talk them into doing this work? Then they came to us and said, we're going to do this work. Come and help us make it happen. And they've been absolutely tremendous. They've fenced huge areas of forest. They've planted corridor intersections. They've, on the advocacy side, they with the local school over there, they've got a forest classroom that Carmel and her daughter have been teaching the kids over there about the forest and the plants and the birds and the wonders of nature, I guess. The third thing that's happened is this wonderful iwi Tapuweka, who were based sort of around Te Puke area, have put a number of people through the Bay Conservation Alliance course that we talked about earlier. They've got a really good team of forest practitioners, young people who are keen and eager, and they've taken a big chunk of their own land and they've begun a project. I think it's up to 700 hectares or something they got bait stations into. So this year they're doing protection in that with their first operation. So we've suddenly, this thing is just taking off. We've had other entities come along and say, well, we want to get involved, we want to help out. We've got support from, well, actually it's Te Puke Forest and Bird, who are the representatives of Forest and Bird on our group. And that's because they were the ones who advocated in the early days for the government to do something about Kukaku at both Rotorua and Kaharoa. So it kind of seems nice that they're the ones that are involved with KEEP. We've got the Western Bay Opini District Council on board helping us out with stuff. It's just skyrocketing. Everybody sort of wants to be part of this because it's such a big thing. It's the first time it's been done in New Zealand at this sort of scale. We've got good support from plant providers. We've got good support from funding providers. We've got a lot of very good skills within the group coming from these different groups. You know, from the Bay of Plenty Regional Council or from DOC, we've got some really good support. And so this thing is just really taking off. So areas being planted, forests being protected, trying to improve the knowledge and the ability for these people to put in pest control. All we do is make the stupid birds go there.
You need to speak for Kukaku.
We don't know which way they're going to go. They could go the opposite way. They could go south, for all we know, rather than north, or they could go west. But it doesn't really matter. So long as they're going into viable forest and we can get protection of that forest area, we'll be fine with it. It's just giving them more area to expand into. And we kind of see that the potential, the same thing is now happening for my Taniwanuku Kiwi Trust. So they're, of course, they're an integral part of KEEP. And the birds are also spreading out of their block. It's not that their block's full, it's just that when you put birds into a new area, they try to go home, and some of them have tried. They've gone part of the way back towards Kaharoa. So good old OKT, they recognised this in one of their surveys and immediately extended their pest control with bait stations all around where the birds were living. And so it's expanding from Otaniwanuku outwards and expanding from Kaharoa towards them. So, you know, I think we originally, our target was within 10 years to join those two areas. And one way we could enhance and increase that, and we are certainly talking with the DOC about this, is perhaps poking some birds in between somewhere. So we get some birds from elsewhere, put them in between, and then we've sort of sped up the whole process, I guess. You've got an into sort of a mini population in between those. And that would be a really nice way of improving genetics in the area. If we take birds from elsewhere and bring them in, we get a new boost in genetics, but also a way to speed up this whole process. I'll be dead before this happens, but the whole process, the whole intention is that this isn't just Kaharoa to Otani Wanuku. It started with Kaharoa because we didn't have enough area, but the intention is, and the potential is there, that we could join all the populations in the Bay of Plenty. Just, it'll take time. It might take 50 years or 60 years or 100 years, but it's there, it's possible, and we can do it. So this is just the beginning of that whole enormous long process.
That's cool. Awesome.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And every other animal and bird will benefit from it. The Paraiti folk, because they're interested in what was in the area, it's not just freshwater and kōkaku, they put AR4 acoustic monitors around all their farms. Every single one of them had bats. Every single one of them had long-tailed bats. It's just another thing that excites them and encourages them and want them to improve. And if we protect those blocks, the bat numbers will increase.
That's so great. I mean, you protect the most vulnerable bird, and it gives the habitat and the foundation that other species need. I think it sounds like when you make a community group, it's individuals coming together for a common good. And it sounds like in many ways, the way that Keeps evolved has been organizations or groups of individuals coming together, having Port Blakeley, the forestry, the councils, the iwi, catchment groups, and community groups all aligning and uniting. So it's almost like a community, but on a larger scale. And it's funny, I think about wildlife corridors in terms of you plant some trees and you do your work, and it's quite mechanical, stuff happening on the ground. But every person we talk to on this podcast, it seems to continually come back to there's actually people and humans and relationships that are driving this change. And it's so fascinating to hear just how you're drawn to this common goal, and that what you see as far as the corridors go is underpinned by the human relationship.
Oh, it's so important. You know, we do a lot of networking, and we constantly come away thinking what lovely people. It's very unusual to find a greenie who's not a really nice person. and you go to these groups and you network with people, you're always learning stuff between the groups. All have generally got the same long-term plan of, you know, saving the forest or saving a species or saving a wetland or whatever it happens to be. So they've all got generally the same philosophy in life that, you know, money's perhaps not the only thing you're interested in. It's actually
the environment,
your surroundings, other people. And, you know, it's just, it's a lovely community to be in. And I think that's part of it. Everyone's got a common goal. We all know that we've stuffed the planet, and we can do our little bit to try and help it. And so I guess we're just a little community within the whole general community of people with like mind.
Yeah, look, I think it's inspiring how that little bird, the kōkaku, you know, inspired you guys to protect it when no one else, when there wasn't money for the officials to do it. And now it's inspiring the wider community to work together to become guardians, you know, for the forest all together. For the habitat, and the knock-on effect is just, it's going to be immense, you know, such a large area, everything else has space to thrive as well, and to me that's inspiring. It's incredibly cool.
It's awesome for us. I mean, we thought we had our little project, and now it's all over the place with all sorts of other involvement. Kiwi people, as Hoxtails, frog people, there's all sorts of different people with different interests and expectations and care all coming together really to make one giant massive forest for everybody to use, and everybody to enjoy.
That's so cool.
So it's private forest, it's public available forest, it's all sorts of stuff that's being involved here.
A mosaic of different types.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I was just going to say that we also find as we're traveling that, and these are unheralded sort of people as well, we keep coming across these rich buggers, and they're doing unbelievable conservation work just quietly without any fanfare or knowledge from other people or outside influence, doing amazing things in big tracts of forest that are privately owned or big tracts of environment that are privately owned. They don't get any sort of, and they don't ask for kudos, they don't ask for a pat on the back, they just think it's the right thing to do, and it's not just little, you know, like we don't own any forest or anything. We're just playing around on public conservation land. But there are a lot of individuals in New Zealand making a big difference because they got money and they got land and they are working on it. Everyone's working on the same goal, except the bloody politicians.
Yeah. It's very true.
Yeah.
So let's say we manage to connect Ōtane Wanuku to Kaurua, and Kama said that there's a chance of connecting all of the Bay of Plenty populations. What are the future prospects for Kōkako? What does success look like?
Oh, gee, that's tough. There's lots of populations of Kōkako around the North Island, and they're not all doing well. Despite them all getting some sort of protection, or almost all of them, they're not all success stories. So I think the future for Kōkako is good, so long as we can, individual groups can continue to get funding to do the work they need to do. I mean, it's as quick as 2 years you've gone from birds leaving nests to none leaving nests if you don't protect them. So you have to stay on top of protection. Funding is always going to be an issue for all the different groups, but there are more and more groups being developed. It was only about 6 or 8 years ago, I think, now that the birds have returned to Taranaki, and there's a couple of groups down there working with Kōkako. So there's going to be more and more areas where Kōkako are restored to where they had been. The difficulty is going to be, and it's a learning exercise, is understanding the changes that are happening in our forest that might be limiting what we want to do. And they're probably global warming problems. Some of them will be to do with we don't fully understand some of the interactions between the forest, the birds, and the predators. The things that we still haven't resolved yet. There are a few populations still in trouble, even though they're getting protection.
And what we're also learning is ungulates have a huge part to play in this. And you can have really good pest control in your forest, but if you don't have a really diverse, healthy forest system, ecosystem, there's not enough food for them, and there's not enough food for them like at crucial times, like through the breeding season when they need to feed their chicks and keep them themselves in good condition. So there's a lot involved, and having a healthy forest is a big part of it. It's not just the pest control. And I think people are finding this throughout New Zealand because ungulates have got out of control in so many places. The forests are just completely eaten out by deer and goats and wallabies and rooted up by pigs. And it means that there's no succession of vital species that are food into the future for all sorts of species. And Kōkako are an iconic species. And if you can have a healthy Kōkako population, then it speaks about the health of the forest long term. If you can have a healthy, sustainable Kōkako population, then it does indicate that the forest is in pretty good health. And that's what we're always aiming for, is not just looking after Kōkako, but looking after the whole forest and making it a really healthy ecosystem.
Yeah, I see this so often. And you go into a forest and there's kawakawa, pijamwood or porokaifuri, and maybe some kamea or supplejack vines, and you know that there's a lot of ungulates and a lot of deer and pigs, and you see the pig marks ripping the roots out of the ground. So really what you're saying is a successful future for Kōkako is a successful future for the whole ecosystem. And without the whole ecosystem being healthy, Kōkako can't truly thrive.
Yeah, you're right.
And it's, many people won't like to hear this, but it's becoming more and more evident that it's not essential, but it's certainly well up on the list of requirements, Aerial 1080. The areas that are doing well are getting Aerial 1080. The areas that aren't doing well don't. It's almost that straightforward. It's the effort and the cost required of putting toxins into bait stations is enormous compared with just having some money and saying, fly over here and do this job, where you can distribute your toxins into the tops of trees. A lot of rats never come out of the trees. They never come to the ground. So you can have a poison operation on the ground and there's still rats in the trees. Possums, of course, live in trees. They do come to the ground, of course. But you're not getting some of those animals if you don't have an aerial application where some of those toxins are landing in the trees. And you can't get into the little dangerous nooks and crannies where you can't put people because it's too steep, too cliffy, whatever. You just have to have that good coverage every 3 years to knock down all the predators. I mean, we use 1080 in bait stations, And that's the only time we get to control stoats properly and cats, because we get them as bikill. And they're probably a problem for Cork. Well, not so sure about the cats necessarily, but certainly the stoats are a huge problem for Corkuckle. So yeah, the future probably is finding another 1080 or continuing or getting public acceptance of the fact that you have to use it. There is no.
It's a really hard discussion to have in the public space, because it really riles up strong emotions between various different groups. And, you know, I think if you put the birds first and the ecosystem first, at the moment there isn't a better solution. I really hope that we find something better.
Yeah, no, but we wouldn't put any toxins out there if we could. We wouldn't have any chemicals in the forest if we had an option, but there's no option.
I think what a lot of people don't understand is the uniqueness of our biodiversity. New Zealand, Aotearoa, evolved isolated for a long, long time and didn't go through an ice age like Europe. And so a lot of our species are really ancient, and they're not found anywhere else. And it means that they're just so vulnerable to what we've introduced. Basically, we've just brought all these mammals and predators in that just weren't here. So New Zealand was a land of birds, of reptiles, and of invertebrates. There were no land mammals apart from bats. And that is nowhere else in the world is like that. It's really unique. So all our species are really unique. Most of our, I think like 80% of our species in New Zealand of flora and fauna are endemic. They're not found anywhere else. So surely that means we want to hold on to them. You know, they're more precious because they are endemic. And I do feel like we have a responsibility for the planet to hold on to that biodiversity. It's not just for New Zealand, it's actually for the whole planet that biodiversity doesn't get lost. So, yeah, I think people often don't understand the uniqueness of our species. And regarding 1080, it's banned in a lot of countries, but it's banned because its dogs are so vulnerable to it. Dogs are more sensitive to 1080, the toxin in it, than birds are. And it's not a nice death. And because there are native dogs in a lot of countries, you know, you don't want to ever use 1080. But it's translated into New Zealand as like it's such a bad thing and no one should use it and it kills everything, which is not the case at all. It's one of the better toxins in terms of breaking down in the environment and not building up in species and becoming a real problem into the future. So there's a lot of misunderstanding about the toxin as well as about our species. And a lot of people don't want to read the research that's been done. There is a lot of research that's been done. And I guess a lot of hunters just don't want a bar of it, because it means when you use 1080 or any toxin on public conservation land, there are restrictions about hunting. And
for sure,
you know, we're a country where recreational hunting is a big thing, and people don't like being locked down in forests.
And it's a major food source for a lot of communities, right? If you don't get your deer and pigs, that's the freezer.
Yeah.
I understand it. It's a tough situation, but that's something. 1080 is something that's outside of the actions that your average everyday person can do. What are some practical actions that people can take to help nature here and now?
I always recommend to people who want to do something is to find a project that's close to where you live. And unless you specifically have an interest in, like, if you really want to work with in the forest, then and you live by a wetland, you might have to travel. But often there are conservation community groups not far from where you live, and that's, if possible, a really good place to start, and then, you know, move from there. If you have specific interests, then you can generally find somewhere where you can volunteer. And volunteering is often the best way to start. You get a good idea of whether it's something that you like doing or not, and you can move around. You know, if you're prepared to give up some of your time, then generally people will be happy to help you and guide you and direct you. I got into conservation by volunteering initially. New Zealand's a small country still, so if you're particularly interested in something and you spend time volunteering, then people will know you and they'll recommend you or not. So volunteering is a really good way to go, of not just helping in the environment, but finding the place where you most enjoy and can have, you know, a good effect.
Or your own skill sets work. I mean, every group has paperwork and secretaries and treasurers and communicators. We don't have any of those skills. We don't have, Kamala and I aren't fantastic communicators in the modern world. We struggle with the technology. It's not just going out and planting a tree, or not just going out and doing some weeding, or it's not just going out and poisoning some, or trapping some rats and possums. It can be desk work. It can be filling out forms and applications. It can be applying for the funding. Filling out forms for funding is horrendous. Typically, they're quite complicated. They involve all sorts of background information. They involve all sorts of stuff that you kind of, when you start filling out the forms, you think, well, this is going to be easy. No, it's not. You need all sorts of people doing those things in conservation.
Mm. So there's lots of ways that you can contribute, and they don't all have to be out in the field.
Yeah.
Play to your strengths.
Educating. Yeah. Following your own strengths. Yeah. It could be educating. You know, teachers who learn enough about the environment to be able to go and teach kids on the weekends, come out, you know, or even joining groups like, I guess, Forest and Bird and places like that, where you join like-minded people. Tramping clubs, many of those people are heavily involved in understanding the conservation world. I think those are the things. You just got to take the step and get involved. Look at what's close to you, as Carmel says. Think about your own skills. Find something you want to do. You know,
yeah, get amongst. Awesome.
Yeah, it's definitely merging what both of you said. To me, sometimes get in touch with your local group and see what they need, because quite often, it's like Ryan said, it's not the answer that you think. It might be the treasurer role and you might be the perfect fit, and without getting your feet dirty. Conservation is such a broad term, which brings me to the question, what does conservation mean to you?
That's a tough question.
We've got all the tough questions today. Just
for you. I don't think I personally thought about it too hard. Conservation to me means saving the environment, I think. Conserving the environment is how I'd simply put it for me.
Yeah, I agree. It's looking after the environment. And you could look at it as a resource, but I actually feel like we share the planet with flora and fauna of all sorts. And because we have and can have such an impact on the environment and the way, by the way we use it or exploit it or whatever, we have and are able to, we need to ensure that it is healthy into the future. I think that it's our responsibility. So working in conservation is a way of looking after the environment to ensure that it's sustainable, that it can keep going, that we don't exploit it. And it benefits us as well, because we've got nothing if we haven't got a healthy environment, and because it includes all our resources as well. So it may seem selfish, but it's not. It's much bigger than that.
I love that, and I couldn't agree more. Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us today and teaching us about kōkako.
No worries. Thanks for the chance.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolute pleasure.